Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Kimberly Atkins, and this is On Point. In New Hampshire yesterday, President Trump announced his administration's new plan to fight the country's opioid epidemic. The president talked tough.
If we don't get tough on the drug dealers, we're wasting our time. Just remember that. We're wasting our time. And that toughness includes the death penalty.
So, lots of red meat. But what about the rest of the plan? And what about the money it'll take to put words into action? This hour on Point, the president's plan to fix the opioid epidemic. You can join us on air or online. Did you hear the plan? Will it help your community? Will you back the president on this? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll look into whether the president's insistent calls for the death penalty for drug dealers can pass constitutional muster. But first, let's get some reaction from New Hampshire, where the president spoke yesterday. Joining me now from Concord, New Hampshire, is Tim Rourke. He chaired the Governor's Commission on Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse Prevention, Treatment, and Recovery, and he now directs the nonprofit New Hampshire Tomorrow. Tim, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Kim. Happy to be here.
So, Tim, before we get to the president's speech, tell our listeners what's happening right now in New Hampshire. How is the opioid epidemic affecting your state?
Sure. You know, we're really seen nationally as ground zero for the epidemic. We have had, along with West Virginia, some of the highest per capita overdose death rates of any state in the United States. It has been traditionally very difficult to access treatment services for addiction, and our prevention system has for a long, long time been under-resourced. So New Hampshire has really been a perfect storm over the last 5 years, where the misuse and abuse of opioid prescriptions really culminated in this wave of fentanyl and heroin addiction, where we've lost over 450 people a year over the last couple of years in New Hampshire. And for a state, a small state like ours of 1.2 million, that's a significant number of people who have died due to drug overdose. So it has created a huge burden on our social safety net system, our healthcare system, and our families who are really struggling to even find help for those who are seeking it.
And you're talking about finding help, Tim. What kind of resources do you need? What kind of what do the folks in these communities need?
You know, I think what we've really been working on in New Hampshire is the effort to develop what we like to call a comprehensive system of care. Addiction is a chronic relapsing condition, but it is also preventable. So the first sort of leg of that stool is making sure that we have good evidence-informed community prevention services in schools, in communities that may be able to early identify individuals who might be at risk of developing a substance use disorder. For those that struggle, we need to make sure that they have rapid access to treatment services to intervene in their disorder and hopefully put them on a path to recovery. And then lastly, we need ongoing, lifelong, community-based recovery support services so that people who have found recovery are able to get the support they need to sustain that recovery over the long term.
So tell us about what you thought of the president's speech. Last year, the president referred to New Hampshire as a, quote, drug-infested den. What did you think of what you heard from him yesterday?
You know, I think what we heard yesterday, some of it was validating to the extent that, you know, the president is calling for a focus on opioid prescribing practices and prevention services, talking about some opportunities to expand and make more available treatment and recovery support services. Those are the efforts that we've had underway in New Hampshire. Other states across the country have begun to do that work. So it was refreshing to see some of that similar language here, which really validates some work we're already doing in the community. I think there has been obviously some questions about, you know, how you balance what we like to call sort of demand reduction work, prevention, treatment, and recovery support services to reduce demand for illicit substances, and how you balance that with what the supply side, which is the law enforcement piece, which, you know, the written plan the president has put forward through the White House is a pretty balanced sort of three-prong approach. His speech yesterday was a little heavy on the law enforcement side, and I think for many in New Hampshire, you know, the conversation for a while has been, we can't arrest our way out of that, and we've been really focusing on building the healthcare system, understanding that. And so I think there are questions about whether or not the plan as presented overemphasizes law enforcement intervention away from some of the healthcare and other public health interventions that we've been working towards for quite some time.
So I want to play you a little bit of sound from Manchester's Mayor Joyce Craig yesterday, hours before the president arrived in Manchester. The mayor told our host station, WBUR, that it'll take money more than words to stamp out the crisis.
I would hope that he'll allocate federal funds to help us continue helping those who need it most. We've seen treatment and recovery providers in Hampshire close their doors due to the lack of funding. So, you know, in this time of great need, Manchester needs more than promises. We really need some action.
Do you agree with that, Tim?
I think so. You know, what we've been waiting for in New Hampshire is money. You know, we have done about as much as we can do. We have treatment providers that have expanded, recovery centers that have opened up in the state, people with lived experience coming out, schools and communities beginning to put in place evidence-based prevention services, but all of those things come at a cost. It's been good to see some movement in Congress, potentially with the identification of about $6 billion in the current proposed federal budget that would go towards the opioid epidemic. But we're at a place in our state, and I think this is true in many other places, where we are not going to be able to achieve long-term sustainable scale of the solutions we need to see in community without some influx of financial investment to make sure that that can happen and then be stabilized. It's very, very difficult for people to find treatment services and recovery services. It's very difficult to feel ready to ask for help. We need to make sure that help is available, and not just today, but 5 years from now and 10 years from now. And I think it is the ability to take this plan. It's one thing to have a plan on paper and talk about it in broad strokes. It's another thing to put resources where they're needed. And that's the next step that I think we desperately need.
All right, Tim Moore, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Kim. Happy to be here.
Well, the administration's 56-point plan was put together by the President's Commission on Combating Drug Addiction and the Opioid Crisis. And one of the six members of that commission was Bertha Madras. She's a psychobiologist at McLean Hospital in Massachusetts and an expert on addiction biology. She joins me today from Bethesda, Maryland. Professor Madras, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Kim. I'm delighted to be here.
So what did the commission put together this proposal? What are the details, and how can it work to help communities like the ones in New Hampshire we've been hearing about?
The commission's report of 56 recommendations included prevention, treatment, recovery, and supply reduction, all four. And as I've said many times, we can't prevent our way out of this crisis, we can't treat our way out of it, and we can't arrest our way out of it. We need all three. The report was quite balanced. It was, in fact, if you look at the 56 recommendations, it was quite heavy on prevention, intervention, treatment, and there were only a few pages and a few recommendations that were related to the criminal justice system.
But the president seemed to focus a lot on that. Is there any concern that the administration is focusing more on that law enforcement aspect of the plan?
I am not concerned at all about that, because the president has put in writing that he accepts all 56 recommendations. I have heard from at a meeting at a White House summit from five cabinet members in which they mentioned reductions to practice, strategic plans related to 40 of the 56 recommendations in just candid remarks without any prepared remarks. So I am convinced that almost all these recommendations are going to be implemented. I'm not that concerned about whether or not he focused on law enforcement or treatment prevention in yesterday's speech. I know that at the level of the federal government, where I'm sitting right now in a conference room at the National Institutes of Health, there is a tremendous a level of energy targeting prevention, treatment, recovery, and recovery support services.
All right, we have Daniel on the line calling from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Kim. Great show today. Just wanted to salute what I'm hearing from your interviewee so far and say that after years of following our drug problems in this country, it's obvious to me that any long-term solution we're going to have is going to come from that evidence-based treatment, that no matter how much law enforcement we throw at the issue, no matter what kind of threats, death penalties we put as repercussions, as long as there is a demand, there will always be a supply. And we have to start with that community-based healthcare approach.
Thanks, Daniel. Professor Madras, what do you think about that evidence-based treatment, and how is that funded?
Evidence-based treatment is simply one prong in the approach. If we don't stop the pipeline, we're not going to ever be able to catch up. So we need evidence-based treatment, but we also need prevention. Supply reduction is a form of prevention. Very few people in this country know that in 2006, 1,000 people died due to fentanyl overdoses. And once a super lab in Mexico was taken out and the leader arrested, the fentanyl supply disappeared, and so did those overdose deaths.
And
we went back to baseline at that time with regard to fentanyl. So we cannot dismiss the criminal justice components as being ineffective. We have to prevent. We have to reduce the demand for drugs. We have to treat people who are in need of treatment, but we must also clamp down on illicit supplies of both prescription drugs as well as other types of opioids.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. We're talking about the White House's plan to stamp out the epidemic of death and addiction to fentanyl, heroin, painkillers. That's taking tens of thousands of lives each year in this country. You can join the conversation. What did you hear in the president's plan? What do you need in your community? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest is Bertha Madras, one of the authors of the report put out in November by the President's Commission on Combating Drug Addiction and the Opioid Crisis. I'd like to bring in Helen Jones Kelly into the conversation. She's Executive Director of Alcohol, Drug Addiction, and Mental Health Services for Montgomery County, Ohio, and she's been an important reality check for us as we've covered the national epidemic over recent years. She joins us from Dayton, Ohio. Helen, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you.
So let's start out by giving our listeners an idea of what the situation is like there in Ohio.
Well, I heard the first speaker talk about being identified as Ground Zero, and that's certainly one of the monikers that we've had in Ohio for the last several years with respect to overdose deaths in our communities. And I'm in Dayton, Ohio, which has been described repeatedly as the place where this all seems to hit the ground with really severe vengeance. So things have changed, frankly, and over the last year or so. We've had a lot of efforts that have created some solutions for us, but we continue to struggle, of course, with people dealing with brain illness around addiction.
And Helen, what are some of those things that you said have helped the most?
Probably the most important aspect of our problem solutions here have been around bringing people together in a collective impact or collaborative model. So we have a lot of efforts going on in the communities, but we brought them together under one umbrella, and that allowed us to amass critical resources to really address the problem and go 6 feet deep as opposed to 6 feet wide. And we've seen the benefit of that. We no longer have a heroin problem in the way that we did. We still have a huge fentanyl problem, though, with other drugs that are coming into the community.
All right. Listener Dahlia Rubera commented on Facebook, education and awareness is the answer. Offer and demand make a two-way road. If there are buyers, there will always be sellers. That's similar to the point that the president made yesterday, saying he's a big fan of commercials, scared straight commercials, to keep people from getting hooked on drugs in the first place. And he plans to devote federal dollars to that kind of information campaign.
So that kids seeing those commercials during the right shows on television or wherever, the internet, when they see these commercials, say, I don't want any part of it. That's the least expensive thing we can do, where you scare them from ending up like the people in the commercials, and will make them very, very bad commercials.
Professor Matras, how will these very, very bad commercials help to combat the opioid crisis?
Well, I think there are many ways of reaching young people with regard to prevention messages. The internet and social media is clearly one of the most important venues for our future advertising campaign. And we can have messages that are bidirectional, so that when kids click on a site that's pro-drug, you can get a pop-up that is anti-drug. With regard to television, we know that some commercials that are based on a number of research projects can be very effective in providing reasons to stay away from drugs. And I think that that is what the president is addressing. I think we need a national media campaign, because we have become a nation of chemical coping and chemical reward, both of which can lead to chemical slavery. And we have to denormalize drug use as a method of both pleasure as well as averting pain.
Helen, what do you think about this national media campaign that the professor talked about?
I actually struggle with that, because I don't think images scare our young people straight when you think about the types of things that they see anyway on social media. And we run the risk of triggering people to use. The images can create, for some people, the response to go out and use. I think the community awareness piece and the engagement piece is probably the most important thing we can do, but we need to do it by arming young people and parents and their caregivers with information, so that they can talk about why a young person should not indulge in misuse of drugs. When we think about brain development and the fact that most of our young people don't have a level of executive functioning yet, you can't just assault them with images and think that that's going to help them learn not to do it. You have to have somebody that's engaged with them, involved with them, that they look up to and are willing to listen to in those kinds of important, intentional conversations.
All right. Alan is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Kim. How are you?
I'm good. You're on.
Okay. I've spent over 50 years working in the addiction treatment quarter, first as a treatment provider directly, and then as a lawyer now. And let me tell you something. First of all, and I'll start with the financial part, the president is a hypocrite, you know, because one of the first things he did was cut back on Medicaid funding, which provides for the treatments for most of the addicts. That's number one. And he wouldn't declare it a national enough emergency in order to create that funding. Second of all, based on my many years of experience, when you increase the criminal penalties, people do not come in for treatment because they're afraid of being arrested. They don't sit there and say, well, I'm a large dealer or I'm a small, you know, dealer or I just use. They start worrying, and so they don't come to treatment. Third issue is that if we're really concerned about the heroin epidemic and the opiate epidemic, first of all, why is it that we haven't burned the poppy fields in the countries that are the major providers? It used to be that Afghanistan produced 75% of the world's opiate, you know, amount, and they chose not to do it because it was interfering with their economy.
Yeah, I want to get to the issue of sourcing in just a moment. But Professor Madras, can you address that issue about increasing penalties, perhaps disincentivizing people to seek treatment?
Well, I think that this gentleman is conflating two issues. The president's strategy with regard to people who are low-level felony offenders is to provide them treatment in prisons, to provide aftercare after prison, to expand drug courts in order to give people a choice of treatment or prison. And he expanded it beyond our commission report, which was to expand it in the federal system. And his declaration was that we should also include states and local prisons. There is a very humane and compassionate approach to people who are nonviolent offenders and very low level with regard to treatment. So I think that's a misrepresentation. I think the hard-nosed attitude is towards major traffickers that have killed, with regard to fentanyl, 20,000 people in our nation this past year. And I think we cannot conflate the two and just use sound bites to say that this is the way it works. The other thing that we have to recognize is that Congress's FY18, the Omnibus bill, which is coming before a vote in the next few days or weeks, asked for $3 billion for this year and next year for the opioid crisis, which is six times more than was in the previous year, fiscal year of 2016. On top of that, the president has asked for an additional $7 billion for FY19. Which starts October the 1st of this year. So he is committing not only resources, all his cabinet secretaries that are relevant to the problem, but also committing funds to try to address the problem. And he's trying to address every single component as well as criminal justice. We know that this crisis was driven by opioid prescription supply. Mm. It was the trigger point. The increased supply led to many more people using. And by reducing supply, we are going to reduce the number of people who have access to this very dangerous level of drugs, unprecedented in our history. And that is a very critical piece of addressing this public health crisis.
All right. Brian is on the line from Litchfield, Connecticut. Hi there, Brian.
Hey, Kim, how are you?
I'm good. Go ahead. You're on point.
So, but I'm not understanding. I don't have control.
Brian, can you speak a little more clearly into your phone? We're losing you a bit.
Sure. What I'm not understanding is that we have a system in place to stop the average user from basically overusing. The federal government already has a program in place for the release of pseudoephedrine, to only a limited gram amount per person per month. And usually it's not even enough to cover what you need. And you have to produce your license, which your intake is directly connected to that. I'm wondering why we're not using this for other medications, which we know that are harmful and which are being overused and overabused. I mean, I've worked in the healthcare system. We've seen people go from doctor to doctor and go to different pharmacies and be able to fill these really, really dangerous prescriptions and then sometimes even sell them on the street. Why aren't we using this system to actually combat that?
Helen, what do you think? Is there a tougher system in place when it comes to cold medicine than when it comes to these opioids?
Well, that's absolutely true that, you know, the cold medicine's behind the counter now. But the other part of that is we are using that system
pretty well now to measure legal prescriptions. It's what's being produced illegally in chemistry labs in basements and other areas. It's the illegal drugs that have really driven this issue. Once we realized what legal prescriptions were doing and they were leading to misuse or abuse, then the illegal chemists began to develop their own and to sell them on the street because people could not get access to prescriptions anymore by forum shopping across doctors.
Okay.
May I weigh in on this?
Yeah, go ahead.
In 2005, 90% of people who were heroin users had started with their first exposure was prescription opioids. 10 years later, it is 67%. So there still is a vast array of prescription opioids that are introducing people to this this class of drugs. And I think we have to interdict supplies both of prescription opioids as well as fentanyl, its analogs, and heroin.
Professor Madras, I want to get to the issue of where these drugs are coming from. The president really focused on the issue of drugs coming over the southern border, but a recent federal government report concluded that China was the source of a lot of the drugs leading to the epidemic in places like Florida and other southern states and throughout the country. Is that true?
It is true that China is the major producer of fentanyl and fentanyl analogs. Heroin is being produced mainly in Mexico and in some parts of South America. But some of the fentanyl is getting shipped to Mexico where it's coming across the border. Other venues are the U.S. Postal Service, in which China is shipping directly to our country. FedEx, if we had FedEx throughout the country as a postal service, we would be able to track and trace every single shipment. Our postal service currently does not track and trace, and one of the recommendations was to do the same type of tracking and the same vigilance within our borders once packages arrive here.
All right, Jason is calling from Falmouth, Massachusetts. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Kim. How are you?
I'm good. You're on point. Go ahead.
Thank you. I just wanted to weigh in on this. The scare tactics are absolutely not going to work. I am an addict in recovery. I've been clean almost 2 years now. And I've seen it firsthand. I've seen people go out in front of me and not make it back, and it didn't scare me into recovery. The only thing that's going to help, we need more beds. We need more funding for treatment. We need to just get that through to people. People think, you know, I don't have insurance, I can't go to rehab. I live in Massachusetts. You don't have rehab, you go. I mean, you don't have the health insurance, you go into rehab. They will still take you. And that's where it all needs to change, is with this health care. We need the beds. We need the health care to absolutely fix this problem.
Helen, what do you think about that?
I absolutely agree. We need more beds to be available when people are ready to go into treatment. And that's a big piece of it. We also need to have back our ability to test and develop evidence-based practices, because that's one of the areas that's been cut in terms of budgeting, and that's a real loss to us for our national registry on evidence-based practice. We also need good aftercare. We need dollars to make sure that we're helping people bridge from treatment into supportive and sustainable environments so that they're able to be successful in recovery. Those are the areas where we need to focus.
All right. A listener on our website writes, it's not an opioid crisis. It's an access problem just like guns. Professor Madras, is there a connection there or a correlation?
Between guns and opioids, I would not draw that correlation. I think the biggest problem that we've had is an oversupply of prescription opioids that triggered the current crisis that was subsequently fueled by clandestine labs in China and in other countries. And we have to We have to expand treatment. We have to expand evidence-based treatment. We have 14,000 treatment centers in the country. Less than a third of them would come anywhere near the standards that I think are evidence-based and adhere to principles of quality treatment. So these treatment centers have to bring to bear improvements on their own. The federal government cannot mandate the quality of treatment except where they reimburse for it. The other major problem is Congress is allocating resources from the Cures Act inappropriately. Mm. They've allocated $8 million to West Virginia, which is the hardest hit state. It makes no sense. Mm. We have to allocate resources where the needs are the greatest for treatment, for recovery, and for rescue.
All right. I want to thank the two of you for your time. Bertha Madras is an addiction expert at McLean Hospital here in Massachusetts and one of the authors of the president's report on fighting opioids. Thank you, Bertha.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
And Helen Jones Kelly is executive director of Alcohol, Drug Addiction, and Mental Health Services in Montgomery County, Ohio. Helen, thank you.
Thank you, Kim.
All right, we will be right back. I'm Kimberly Atkins, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. The key message from the president is that it will take harsh penalties and, more importantly, the death penalty to stamp out the network of drug dealers who profit from the opioid epidemic. And we're going to talk about that now. You can join the conversation. Do you agree with the president? Can countries like China, Singapore, and Saudi Arabia and Iran teach us a thing or two about stamping out the drug trade? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Columbus, Ohio, is Douglas Berman. He's a professor at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. Doug, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Kim.
And Mara Stith McLeod is joining us from Notre Dame, Indiana. She's an associate professor at the University of Notre Dame Law School. Mara, thank you, too.
Hi, Kim. Thanks.
So I want to get this discussion of penalties started by playing a little bit of what the president said in Manchester, New Hampshire yesterday about the current penalties drug dealers face being too lax.
Some of these drug dealers will kill thousands of people during their lifetime and destroy many more lives than that. And they'll get caught and they'll get 30 days in jail, or they'll go away for a year, or they'll be fined. And yet if you kill one person, you get the death penalty or you go to jail for life. So if we're not going to get tough on the drug dealers who kill thousands of people and destroy so many people's lives, we are just doing the wrong thing.
So before I ask you both whether the president should impose this kind of penalty, let's start with asking whether he can. Doug, is a death sentence for a drug trafficker constitutional?
That's actually unclear right now. It's an issue that has been discussed, especially in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision in 2008 that said the Eighth Amendment prohibits using the death penalty for the crime of child rape. And the thought is if there isn't a direct and perhaps intentional causing of a death, that the death penalty may not be available constitutionally. However, in a footnote, the court in that child rape case said, well, we're talking here about an individual crime that doesn't lead to a death, perhaps treason and crimes against the state, where they listed kingpin status in drug dealing. That's a different kind of crime. We're not speaking to that. And so that opinion at least seems to leave open the possibility that an existing federal statute that suggests super kingpin drug dealers are death eligible might be permissible under the Constitution.
And the Eighth Amendment, of course, prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. Mara, what do you think? Would a plan like this pass constitutional muster?
Yeah, I tend to agree with Professor Berman on that open question. I think there are two possible ways that such a death penalty might be deemed constitutional. And I'm thinking of a situation where we're applying the law to high-level administrators, organizers, leaders of drug operations here, importers, manufacturers, that type. Federal law currently permits the death penalty for those kinds of high-level drug dealers, even without a link to death. So I think the administration is probably were thinking of those folks. And I think that the Kennedy opinion there, it's an opinion by Justice Kennedy in that 2008 case, leaves open the idea that those count as crimes against the state. We've heard on your program about the kind of social harms here. So I think that there's a chance the court might be willing to permit that. There's another means as well. I think it's a little less concrete, but in Tyson versus Arizona in 1987, the Supreme Court found that reckless disregard for human life, implicit in knowingly engaging in criminal activities known to carry a grave risk of death, can support the death penalty when the conduct results in death, which is a natural result, even if it's not an inevitable one. So, you know, the defendants in that case were major participants in the criminal activities. So I think there's a chance that that precedent might also provide a different support. But either of those two ways are plausible. And I would note that, you know, you just need a coalition of justices. You've got Justice Kennedy suggesting crimes against the state are an open question, maybe subject to the death penalty, even if you don't link them to deaths. We also have Justice Alito, Roberts, Thomas on the record saying that you don't have to have an intentional intent to kill the death penalty. Child rape, they would have permitted in that case, and presumably Justice Gorsuch would join them. So you got five justices there. I think it's plausible that it might be upheld.
And yet another case that could hinge on Justice Kennedy's vote if it reaches the court. Let's go now to the issue of deterrence. I mean, whether this sort of plan threatening death for drug dealing might even have an impact on drug dealers. Doug, what do you think?
I'm inclined to say no, largely because all of the research done on deterrence suggests that it's the certainty and swiftness of a punishment rather than its severity that's likely to have the biggest deterrent impact. And the one thing you can say for certain about the death penalty in the United States is it's anything but certain, it's anything but swift. You know, our appellate system and our commitment to due process often leads to, you know, 10, sometimes 20 years between even a capital conviction and a death sentence being carried out. And in fact, in the federal system, we haven't had an execution in more than 15 years, about 15 years. And then on top of that, the number of cases that would be brought would, I still imagine, be relatively small compared to the number of drug dealers, serious drug dealers that are out there. And so the certainty of getting the punishment for any one offender would be so low that all of our deterrence theory would suggest this isn't going to have much of any of an impact.
Okay. Alice is calling from Detroit. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Kim. The first thing I want to say is I commend everybody on the swiftness that they're going after a solution for the opiate addiction. But I'm pretty dismayed over the fact that when crack cocaine ran rampant through black neighborhoods, none of this was going on. It was all about criminalizing the addicts and criminalizing those who were on the point of selling. When the president says we should do it like other countries, one of the things he fails to take notice of is we're a democracy. We're about human rights. And rather than look at drug dealers as being those who are purveyors of death, look at the reasons why they're selling these drugs. A lot of them do it because they feel like they have no other economic means to take care of their families. So are we saying that we want to go ahead and put them to death because they're trying to survive?
Yeah. Mara, what do you think about that?
No, I'm very sympathetic with that view. I think the picture of the folks who are high-level distributors of opioids may be slightly different and certainly, I think, a less sympathetic picture. I think the folks that we're talking about possibly being subject to the death penalty are really high-level people here in the drug in the criminal organizations. So that gives me some comfort. I totally agree on the ground that we need to be focusing a lot more on providing social structures that are going to offer alternatives to people who feel otherwise, that drugs are their only means of putting food on the table.
Let's listen to another part of the president's speech yesterday when he talked about looking to other countries for guidance about his approach to drug prevention.
If you look at other countries, I've gotten to know the leaders of many countries.
And I won't mention names, but you know the countries I'm talking about. I go around, how's your drug problem? We don't have much of a drug problem. What do you mean you don't have a drug problem? Well, we don't have. I say, how come? We have zero tolerance for drug dealers. I say, what does that mean? That means we have the death penalty for drug dealers. We don't have a drug problem.
So one of the countries the president has mentioned is China, but a recent report points out that about 1.52 million drug users were addicted there. And one of the ways China is trying to combat that is through drug detoxification and rehabilitation programs. So is there enough data really to know what these other countries are doing and to apply the same practice, Doug?
That's always a challenging issue, and it's especially notable that at least what I think the president is referencing tend to be more repressive regimes, certainly not ones that have the kind of open flow of information. And not only is it challenging to trust the data that comes out of some of these countries, but you could understand why if you have a zero-tolerance death penalty for involvement with drugs, you're not going to get honest reporting if you're trying to find out from individuals who's involved with drug use or struggling with addiction. And so it's, you know, one of those sort of appealing surface level ideas that if we say we won't tolerate drug use, we won't have drug use. But the reality on the ground is a lot more complicated and also relates to, you know, a range of cultural realities as well in terms of just a history of involvement with drug activity or an open society almost always is going to have more exposure to a range of other activities that may or may not be consistent with what the ruling government thinks is appropriate for people to be doing.
Yeah, and a Washington Post piece this week points out that when the president mentions opioid abuse, he often praises leaders of countries where people are executed, sometimes through extrajudicial means, such as in the Philippines, and there's concern about due process there. What about here, Mara? Are there due process concerns or concerns about the effects we've seen from other past get-tough drug policies, whether it's disparities in sentencing or prison overpopulation?
Well, I certainly think that we've seen problems with that. I mean, my problem with the death penalty is that these comparisons just aren't practical. We have constitutional protections that simply do not make it possible to execute people with the kind of speed that these other countries do. So we're talking about a very, very expensive, entailed, uncertain process, and it's a costly one. So it sends an expressive signal. Our death penalty has been focused on retributive justice. That's what the Supreme Court has focused on. There's certainly other rationales. But the idea that it's going to serve as an effective deterrent, I think, is as it supposedly does in these other countries, I think is not a really honest approach to what its effect or justification would be. And I think mandatory minimum, there are very, very strong mandatory minimum. We're talking severe penalties up to life in prison already. I think we get most of the benefit already under current law. And the real problem is trying to go with those penalties in a consistent and certain manner. As Professor Berman said, it's certainty rather than duration of penalty that the evidence suggests is going to be more effective.
John is calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi there, John.
Hi, Kim. I think that the death penalty idea is outrageous. Who are the major dealers? The drugs have been coming from Afghanistan ever since we went in. Who are the real dealers?
Doug, what do you think?
I think that's a serious concern, whether especially if these labs that are producing fentanyl, which is, I think, the drug that President Trump is thinking about killing thousands, you know, are based out of China, based even out of Mexico, if that's where the shipments are coming through, you know, often those folks will stay out of the jurisdiction. Another concern, especially in the operation of our criminal justice system, and we've seen this with the application of mandatory minimums and other tough punishments, is the folks who are higher up in an organization often have the most information to trade as part of assisting the government, substantial assistance. We see plenty of stories of high-level dealers who might otherwise be subject to high-level penalties readily cutting deals, part of pleas, part of cooperation, to avoid those extreme punishments. And our laws are structured to try to get that information by allowing those punishments to go away. And that's what we often see in other death penalty contexts as well, where there will be multiple people involved in a particular crime. And perhaps the folks most responsible for a murder or other bad crimes end up being the first to run into the prosecutor's office and agree to testify against lower level participants. Mm. And they're the ones who end up get subject to those extreme punishments. And that's where the concern about disparities in the application of these laws is extreme, including, as the caller suggests, that we may not even have access to or knowledge about who's behind some of these shipments of drugs that are coming from overseas.
And on the issue of mandatory minimums, we've also seen efforts recently to at criminal justice reform. Does this call for mandatory minimums sort of run headlong into those reform efforts, Mara?
So I think that the real problem here is whom we're talking about. If we could be focused only on the high-level folks, high-volume drug distributors and traffickers, then, you know, the mandatory minimum wouldn't be so concerning. But the problem is where they start netting lower-level people and depriving judges of discretion to provide proportionate penalties. In terms of the high-level folks, I don't think the mandatory minimum are necessary. They're already going to be getting high sentences. So my concern is those do tend to cripple other important efforts to focus our resources on the cases that really deserve it, on the criminals who really deserve it.
Doug, just quickly in the few seconds we have left, one listener asked, well, should there be the death penalty for drug company CEOs?
Certainly, that's where, when hearing your earlier guests talk about prescription opioids being the source of a lot of the problems, both historically and even still today, we need to be asking, you know, not just who's producing these drugs, but do we need to really think more dynamically about who are the real source problems? I don't think anybody would agree that folks doing legal operations in the U.S., even if things go bad, ought to get the death penalty. But it's an example of how we frame a conversation about who's responsible for drug use and abuse in ways that itself build on a set of social realities and social constructions that maybe we need to be rethinking if we want to address this problem from its root.
All right. Douglas Berman is a professor at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. Doug, my many thanks to you.
Thank you, Kim. Appreciate it.
And Mara McLeod is an associate professor at the University of Notre Dame Law School. Mara, thanks for your time.
Thanks.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, Facebook's under fire over how Cambridge Analytica used its customer information. Should the social network be reined in? Should it be regulated? I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.